authorized by the president, senior officials were quoted as elaborating on this concession. In the Washington Post, Walter Pincus published a story headlined, "White House Backs Off Claim on Iraqi Buy," which included a quote, "Knowing all that we know now, the reference to Iraq's attempt to acquire uranium from Africa should not have been included in the State of the Union speech." The New York Times also quoted a senior official who said, "We couldn't prove it, and it might in fact be wrong." It was the first public acknowledgement that the president should not have made the uranium allegation in his State of the Union address, and that the information on which it had been based was incomplete or inaccurate. At the White House, everyone hoped the acknowledgement would put the 16 words controversy to rest. The reality was the opposite. As Deputy Press Secretary, I was supposed to go on the Africa trip with the larger White House press corps aboard its chartered plane, but with Ari's departure imminent, I decided instead to do some preparation for my new job. So while the controversy was beginning to boil and the president was traveling in Africa, I took a little time off to clear my head, get advice from some of my predecessors from previous administrations, and receive overviews from the senior directors in the National Security Council on their foreign policy priorities. Since my background was in communications and Texas politics and not foreign policy, I wanted a thorough rundown of the focus areas abroad with top priority on the high-profile ones. I already had good relations with Condi Rice and her deputy, Stephen J. Hadley, and the meetings would help establish or strengthen relations with key NSC people whose expertise I could call on in times of need. My self-education efforts proved invaluable. But meanwhile, the Niger controversy, having reached critical mass, was expanding. In Washington, it's never enough to simply acknowledge a mistake. The press focus then shifts to follow-up questions. How could the mistake happen? Who was responsible? What are the consequences? The questions don't stop until the hungry media beast is satisfied that it has hunted down all the facts. As the news circled the globe, Prime Minister Tony Blair's team was privately furious with the White House. The British government, which staunchly supported Bush in Iraq, was standing by the Niger claim, maintaining that their intelligence was based on information other than the forged documents. This made the White House concession a serious embarrassment that would cause Prime Minister Blair much media blowback in the near term. Democrats kept the controversy brewing by calling for a congressional investigation. Carl Levin, the ranking minority member of the Armed Services Committee, questioned how the bogus uranium claim had become part of the case for war, and Ted Kennedy suggested it was deliberate deception. Whether legitimate expressions of concern or grandstanding for political gain, their efforts to raise more suspicion about the White House were a natural part of the ongoing partisan warfare that President Bush had promised to end. Now, the way the president had chosen to sell the war to the American people and his reluctance to discuss openly and directly how that case had been made were ensuring his promise would not be kept. The uranium controversy overshadowed Bush's trip to Africa, including his efforts to triple relief funds for combating the AIDS pandemic, fight the malaria scourge, and give Africans hope by promoting development. It was a foretaste of things to come, as the Bush administration would find all its accomplishments increasingly overshadowed by persistent controversies over Iraq. The White House fought back against its critics in the media and on Capitol Hill on several fronts. To defend itself against the accusations of deliberate dishonesty leveled by Joe Wilson, Vice President Cheney and his staff were leading a White House effort to discredit Joe Wilson himself. On a broader front, the White House sought to dispel the notion that the intelligence had been cooked by showing that it had been provided and cleared by the CIA. Most observers, war critics and supporters, Democrats and Republicans, had shared the assumption that Saddam had WMD programs and likely possessed at least some chemical and biological weapons. Only now, after the fact, were some prominent critics disavowing or downplaying their earlier belief, and the partisan tone of their attacks provided us with the gist of our counterattack. But that still left open the emerging question: how and why did our intelligence about Iraq go so badly wrong? And how did the now discredited Niger claim make it into the most heavily vetted speech of the year, the State of the Union address? In a July 11th briefing with a traveling press pool aboard Air Force One on the way to Uganda, Condoleezza Rice was peppered with questions, 40 in all, about the infamous 16 words. While noting that the British continued to stand by the uranium claim, and that the October NIE had referenced efforts to acquire yellowcake in various African countries and not just Niger, Rice added, "We have a higher standard for what we put in presidential speeches. We don't make the president his own fact witness. That's why we send them out for clearance." Was it true, Rice was asked, that the CIA had expressed doubts about the Niger claim to the White House well before the State of the Union? "The CIA cleared the speech in its entirety," Rice replied. "If the CIA, the Director of Central Intelligence, had said, 'Take this out of the speech,' it would have been gone without question. What we've said subsequently is, knowing what we know now, that some of the Niger documents were apparently forged, we wouldn't have put this in the president's speech." Rice would find out several days later that the National Security Council, which she oversaw, bore primary responsibility for the error. Was Rice blaming the Niger error on the CIA? So some newspapers would report after the briefing, not unfairly. Rice denied that was the case. But within hours, CIA Director George Tenet publicly took the blame for the intelligence failure at the request of the White House. "I am responsible for the approval process in my agency," Tenet said, loyally moving to deflect responsibility from the president and those around him. Could the yellowcake citation in the October NIE be declassified so the American people could judge for themselves whether or not the administration had exaggerated it? Reflecting public policy, Rice replied that the White House did not want to try to get into a kind of selective declassification, but we're looking at what can be made available. At the time, she was unaware of the fact that President Bush had already agreed to selective declassification of parts of the NIE so that Vice President Cheney or his top aide Scooter Libby could use them to make the administration's case with selected reporters. Republican congressional leaders didn't like seeing the chief rationale for war being undermined as the 2004 election year loomed. Some seized on Tenet's mea culpa as an opportunity to distance themselves and the Republican president from the blame. Pat Roberts, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, blasted Tenet and was described in the New York Times as being disturbed by extremely sloppy handling of the issue from the outset by the CIA. Roberts also expressed displeasure at a campaign of press leaks by the CIA in an effort to discredit the president, a reference to CIA officials defending themselves over the Iraqi WMD intelligence by suggesting that policymakers had selectively edited the intelligence to make a stronger case for war. The squabbling would leave the self-protective CIA lying in wait to exact revenge against the White House, and the approaching election year would provide a convenient opening. The press loved it all. There are few things reporters enjoy covering more than controversy over internal administration squabbling and the opportunity it provides for gossip, score settling, and backdoor machinations. And within days, another shock from the media would drive the intensity of the coverage even higher. This time, the bombshell was launched not by members of the liberal press, but by a noted conservative reporter, pundit, and commentator, the feisty, beetle-browed Robert Novak. In a July 14, 2003 column titled "Mission to Niger," Novak probed how Wilson's trip had come about and what it concluded. An easily overlooked revelation buried near the bottom of the article started the ball rolling toward a full-fledged Justice Department investigation. Wilson never worked for the CIA, but his wife, Valerie Plame, is an agency operative on weapons of mass destruction, Novak disclosed. "Two senior administration officials told me that Wilson's wife suggested sending him to Niger to investigate the Italian report about yellowcake sales." The point of mentioning Wilson's wife, of course, was to dispel once and for all the notion that Vice President Cheney had somehow arranged Wilson's mission to Niger. The fact that Wilson's wife was involved also carried with it a whiff of nepotism, a vague sense that perhaps there was something improper in the assignment. As if Wilson had been sent by his wife on a junket, to quote the words scrawled in the margin of his own copy of Wilson's op-ed column by none other than Vice President Cheney himself. But the charge of possible nepotism wasn't the reason Novak's column caused an explosion. Rather, it was the first time the name Valerie Plame had appeared in print along with the words agency operative. By revealing Plame's status, Novak inadvertently elevated the Niger controversy into a full-blown scandal. Intentionally disclosing the name of a covert CIA officer, which Plame was, despite some later controversy over that point in the press, to an individual not authorized to know it such as a reporter, is a felony. Novak evidently didn't recognize the seriousness of publishing Plame's identity. Months later, when the Justice Department investigated the leak, Novak wrote that CIA spokesman Bill Harlow had requested that Plame's name not be used in Novak's column because, while she probably never again will be given a foreign assignment, exposure of her agency identity might cause difficulties if she travels abroad. This struck Novak as an inadequate reason to withhold relevant information from the public. Novak defended his actions by asserting that Harlow had not suggested that Plame or anybody else would be endangered, and that he learned Plame's name, though not her undercover identity, from her husband's entry in the well-known reference book, Who's Who in America. And where did Novak get the information about Plame's CIA role in the first place? It would be years before the answer to that question would come to light. In his column, Novak attributed only to two senior administration officials.